You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
3 years ago, Lord Nicholas Stern put together the largest ever study on the costs and benefits of dealing with global warming, and his conclusion was that climate change poses the greatest economic threat to the world, but that action to address that threat has been slow. Now he's written The Global Deal, Climate Change and the Creation of a New Era of Progress and Prosperity, a blueprint for managing climate change while also creating economic growth. Mr. Stern is a former chief economist at the World Bank, currently the I.G. Patel Chair in Economics and Government and Chair of the Grantham Research Institute of Climate Change at the London School of Economics. He served as advisor to the U.K. government on the economics of climate change and development from 2005 to 2007. His new book is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Stern to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
Well, usually when we talk about climate change, we talk about the ecology, not the economy. And you want us to pay attention to this other side of the story?
It's about economic policy. It's about managing risk. Good environment is good economics, and vice versa generally. I don't think you can separate them out. And what I wanted to argue was that if we fail to act strongly now, quickly, on climate change, we will cause immense damage, damage which will very badly affect what we can do, where we can live. It would result in big movements of population and extended conflict, a major disruption in our society and our economies. But if we, on the other hand, take this seriously, think through what we have to do, then at fairly modest cost, we can reduce the risks drastically and create a much more attractive form of growth.
Have you been frustrated by dealings with some other countries? For a long time, the Bush administration dragged its feet, and then you have the president of the Czech Republic who denies that there even is such a thing as climate change.
Well, friends of the United States, and I've lived here for long periods of my life, I hope understand that the United States is a rather varied society, a rather varied political structure. And for many years now, there have been people in the United States that have argued the case on climate change very strongly. There have been states like California that have been moved to action. There have been companies that have seen the potential, that have invested in new technologies. But it is true that when the world looked for leadership at the federal level in the United States under the last administration, they looked with very little hope. But now they, I think, look for the lead which must come from the U.S. if there's going to be any serious action, and of course from China also. They look to the U.S. with much more hope, I think. The president of the Czech Republic is a very minor position. It's a very, very strange view that Václav Klaus has, a complete denial of the science, and really very odd indeed. And I think he's viewed as very odd.
Although he's trotted out by opponents all the time.
Yes, he is. But the number of people who can really be taken seriously who deny the science is tiny or zero.
Now, Tony Blair called the Stern Review the most important report on the future ever published under when he was prime minister. How was it received by other leaders around the world?
It's been very positive. I was asked to join the Grenelle de l'Environnement in France, put together by President Sarkozy, which was a great public discussion on climate change. I've interacted closely with President Barroso of the European Union. He's head of the Commission of the European Union. I've testified twice in on Capitol Hill, once to the House, once to the Senate, and was there for a seminar, extended seminar, chaired by Tony Blair, actually, in March. I've done a lot of work with South African government, with the Indian government. It is a subject which has really gained momentum in terms of political understanding and political commitment over the last two or three years.
The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change is scheduled to take place in Copenhagen in December. You've called it the most important international gathering since World War II, more important than the Kyoto Protocol or any of the other meetings that we've had on the environment?
Yes, because this time the world really is taking the issue seriously, and we have a chance of a strong and clear agreement. The stakes that we're playing for are enormous. If we fail to act on this one, we will transform the planet. We'll take it to 5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial times, probably sometime the end of this century, early next, if we fail to act. We haven't seen that for 30 million years. Human beings have been around. Well, it depends how you count Homo sapiens or what emphasis you put on sapiens, but it's maybe 100, 200,000 years. There's no way that we've ever experienced. We've experienced much colder, and we know much colder transforms the planet, but we've never experienced on this scale. So the stakes we're playing for are really very high.
And then, of course, there are rising sea levels and all sorts of other problems. You write that the two greatest problems of our time are overcoming poverty and combating climate change. Do you see them as linked?
We'll succeed or fail on those two together. If we fail to act on climate change, we'll create a climate so hostile within a few or several decades that it will really undermine the progress that's been made in development and set it back. If, on the other hand, we try to manage climate change by appearing to or actually damaging the campaign or damaging the fight against world poverty, we will not be able to put together the international coalition that this action on this subject demands. So we'll succeed or fail on these two things together.
Well, developing countries play a major role in this discussion, don't they? China is building coal-burning power plants at the rate of one a week. And I'm not sure that they're employing any clean coal technology or whether clean coal technology is even all that clean. India is also heavily reliant on coal. How do you convince them to move away from carbon-emitting energy sources?
Well, about half the world's electricity comes from coal, and it will be widely used. So the challenge will be to get coal to be clean. But you're absolutely right, Leonard, unless the developing world is part of this story, unless the rich world is part of the story, unless we're all part of this story, we're not going to be able to cut emissions on the scale that we have to. But China, you have to look at as a whole. India, you have to look at as a whole. United States, you have to look at as a whole. China's reforesting. It's not deforesting. You can't sell a U.S. car in China. It doesn't satisfy the emissions requirements in the 11th five-year plan, which finishes in China at the end of next year. The objective, which they'll probably achieve, was to cut energy to output by 20%. China is taking this issue very seriously. Why? Because they know they're extremely vulnerable, and they know that they're a potential deal breaker. So you concentrate, and they're concentrating. But we have to, as a rich world, responsible for 60-65% of the concentrations in the atmosphere now, we have to take on big targets ourselves. We have to show what low carbon growth looks like, show that it's feasible, share technologies, and contribute something to the adjustment in the developing world. So it's going to have to be that kind of collaboration.
My guest is Nicholas Stern. His book, The Global Deal, Climate Change and the Creation of a New Era of Progress and Prosperity, is published by Public Affairs. Adaptation is a large part of managing climate change. Can you give us some examples of everyday impacts of climate change on a city like London, for example, and the ways that cities will have to cope with the effects?
For all people, including London, and you can tell by my accent that that's a city I have some attachment to.
Would I assume that what you're going to say would also apply to New York or Tokyo or Johannesburg?
It would in different shapes, different forms. Most of these things operate through water in some shape or form. Storms, floods, droughts, sea level rise. Many cities are on the coast. Many cities are very close to rivers. London is on a floodplain of the Thames. It seems pretty clear now that we're going to get wetter winters and drier summers in London.
Wetter than London winters have been in the past?
Indeed.
Rainy London?
Indeed. And that will mean...
Bring your umbrella every day.
Actually, the overall rainfall in London's not that big, but it's going to be much more concentrated in the winter. That means we're going to need bigger sewers in London, or the sewage will discharge into the Thames. You know, not a happy thought. And when it does occur, and it has occurred from time to time, it's very, very unattractive. So we'll have to invest in sewers. Now, that's one version in London. The storm surges up the Thames are already much more severe than was anticipated when the Thames barrage was built, and it's being used and raised many more times than was anticipated. Now, this is a city that is not particularly badly hit by climate change, but these water phenomena, storms, floods, droughts, sea level rise, will be relevant everywhere. The frequency of hurricanes and the severity of hurricanes in the southern United States is likely to increase. The snows on the Sierras are likely to disappear with unmanaged climate change, with states like California suffering still more seriously from water shortage. It's going to be different in different places, but it's going to be severe everywhere unless we act strongly.
Aren't we already seeing some of the effects? I spoke a couple of years ago to a Brazilian environmentalist who said that hurricanes have hit the Amazon for the first time in the history of Brazil, as far as they know.
We're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it, for example, in Darfur, where extended droughts have meant that populations which rely on animals have moved because the grazing land has dried up and they've had to move. They've come into conflict with those people involved in unsettled agriculture, and you get conflict. We're going to see population and movement and severe conflict on a global scale by the end of this century unless we really act strongly.
But is this anything new? For example, agriculture will obviously be hit, but we've seen drought before. In fact, the Sahara was once a green area, and that was long before there was anything like global climate change.
There will always be fluctuations. The angle of the Earth's orbit changes. You get El Nino and La Nina, which produce big temperature changes in the world. Solar activity in the sun will vary. You'll get volcanic eruptions, and you'll get dust, which will stop heat coming in. All these fluctuations and random occurrences will happen. But what we are doing as human beings is imposing on all that a very powerful underlying trend. It's a trend which is very, very simple science. It's a very simple effect. More greenhouse gases in the atmosphere mean more heat is trapped, means that global warming, the temperature of the Earth increases, and you get climate change. And it's climate change which is the problem. And that trend, which we are creating as human beings by emitting more than the Earth can absorb, is destined to take us over the course of this century into regions the Earth has never seen in its time when humans have been here. And that's very important to remember. We've seen things go down drastically. We've seen things go down 5 degrees centigrade, the last ice age, very recently. We've seen things a little bit warmer than now as human beings, but not much. 3 degrees centigrade more than the mid-19th century has not been seen on the planet for about 3 million years. And humans have been around only about 100, 200,000. Humans simply have not experienced the kind of rewriting and redrawing of the climate and the physical geography that this would bring.
Nicholas Stern is the first I.G. Patel Chair in Economics and Government and Chair of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change at the London School of Economics. He was advisor to the British government and on the economics of climate change and development from 2005 to 2007, head of the Stern Review on the economics of climate change. And he's written a book called The Global Deal, Climate Change and the Creation of a New Era of Progress and Prosperity, published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Nicholas Stern, his book, The Global Deal, Climate Change and the Creation of a New Era of Progress and Prosperity, published by Public Affairs. I was talking about agriculture. What can farmers do to anticipate and manage the effects of climate change?
Well, climate change is going to happen because of what we've done in the past. There are long lags in these systems. And it's going to happen because we can't simply cut our emissions right back overnight.
So climate change is a guarantee. It's a matter of something that we have to accept. It's a matter of how much we can stem it from getting worse than it might?
Absolutely right. For the next three or four decades, we're going to see climate change. If we act strongly, then we can slow it right down and maybe hold it after that kind of period. But to hold it at for three or four decades of climate change or five decades of climate change means acting now because the system has these long lags in it.
What can we do to protect farmers? They can't always get insurance in this country. I don't know if they can in Britain. The insurers often refuse to cover people who live in places deemed high risk of floods or hurricanes.
The first thing is to try to understand what those risks are, and they're highly local. We were talking earlier about flooding in London, and you'd have problems in floodplains for people involved in agriculture in that part of the world. Other parts of the world are going to get much drier. Much of southern Europe is going to get much drier. It's already getting drier, and it's going to get worse. And if we leave it unmanaged, it'll end up looking like the Sahara, probably. So you get very different. Some places will have problems with flooding. Other places will have problems with things drying out. Other places will have more severe hurricanes. Other places will find that they have torrents in the rainy season because the snows have gone to catch, which catch the water, and dry rivers in the dry season. The first thing to do for all of us, particularly for farmers, is to try to understand as best we can where it's likely to go. The second thing is to think about water management, because most of this is about water in some shape or form. Will they have to move still more quickly to low-till agriculture? Farmers in other locations, how can they manage their irrigation in a way that works much better for them? At the same time, there will be opportunities. Different kinds of crops will be used for biofuels. It may be that big parts of the US and Canada could be used for switchgrass to make cellulosic ethanol. So as well as thinking of what's going to happen to their climate and the fluctuations of weather within that climate, which is a very local thing that needs a lot of hard work from our meteorologists and our climate scientists, as well as looking at that, there are going to be quite a lot of opportunities in biofuels, and we're discovering better biofuels all the time, and we're discovering some of the problems with the existing biofuels.
In this country, biofuels generally mean something made out of corn and using up probably more energy than it's worth.
I suspect that corn-based ethanol is a bad idea. But we should not just see that as the only example of biofuels, and therefore biofuels are bad, because some sugarcane-based ethanol seems to be working pretty well at reasonable cost. There'll be lots of cellulosic ethanol, lots of ethanol from waste. Using a lot of the waste that we use could be turned into ethanol. And there are biodiesels that we can turn to. There's a crop called Jatropha, which is like castor oil. You crush it and it makes biodiesel. These are the kinds of things that we have to discover. Algae actually look as if it might well be a source of biofuel. Well-managed forests will also be sources of biofuel. So we have to look across the board, and we have to learn very quickly about what works well.
Well, addressing climate change and lowering carbon emissions is often posited as being at odds with economic growth, but you're suggesting that, if I use your subtitle, that it could lead to a new era of progress and prosperity.
I think that we're going to see low-carbon technologies over these next two or three decades play the role of railways, electricity, and IT at other periods of our economic history as technological and innovation drivers of growth. It's going to need good policy to take us there because markets are failing at the moment to give the right signals. With good policy, markets, that means a proper price for greenhouse gas emissions. With good policy, we're going to get the incentives to make this kind of investment. It's going to be a very exciting period of growth.
So you're suggesting that market-related mechanisms are not the best approach, that governments are going to have to get involved. Now, we've seen some governments get involved. Germany, you cite as a good case, but I remember speaking next to a German salesman of solar panels on an airplane once, and he told me that he would not be able to sell those solar panels if they weren't so strongly supported by government subsidies.
what we're talking about is not abandoning markets, not abandoning market mechanisms, but getting markets to work well. Unless people are charged for the cost that they cause to others, then markets are failing. So without government action, through cap and trade, through carbon taxation, through regulation, markets are failing. The challenge is to get markets to work well, but it does require government policy. You expect to pay for the labour in the goods you buy. You expect to pay for the raw materials in the goods you buy because you deprive others of those things. You inflict costs on others. We inflict costs on others when we emit greenhouse gases. And markets work well, in this case, only through government policy, and that's the challenge.
In this country, we seem to need a crisis, so the U.S. auto industry, being in bad shape, has led President Obama to talk about using this as an opportunity to set new standards for fuel efficiency and for creating hybrid cars. But what about industries that are not in crisis? Can we impose this sort of thing on them?
It's a question of getting the right incentives and the right regulations. If people emit a lot of greenhouse gases, they should pay for those emissions and they'll have an incentive to reduce them. There's some areas which, like car emissions, like home insulation, you may need to have regulation as well because there are other sorts of markets failures and we're in a hurry. But with those policies, I think you're going to see a tremendous reaction. It will involve investment. It will involve some costs, and we shouldn't try to minimize those in terms of dismissing them. We should try to minimize them in terms of supporting technical progress to bring them down as quickly as we can. And if we do succeed in that, it's going to be a very exciting and dynamic period of discovery of new technologies, bringing costs down, exciting forms of investment, and we'll establish a form of growth which is low carbon. And in so doing, we'll establish a form of growth that's more energy secure, cleaner, quieter, and it will be growth. Because let's be clear, high carbon growth will kill itself, first on oil gas prices and second, more fundamentally, on the very hostile environment it will create.
My guest is Nicholas Stern. His latest book, The Global Deal, Climate Change and the Creation of a New Era of Progress and Prosperity, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm sure there are many people out there trying to come up with solutions, and if they could come up with better batteries, they'd make a lot of money, but the technology doesn't seem to be all that promising as of yet.
On the contrary, actually, it's changing very quickly. We've got to recognize this is a fairly young subject in terms of major political emphasis and major business emphasis. The science has been around for a couple of hundred years, and the science has been telling us giving us very strong signals and lessons over the last 50. But in terms of politics and in terms of business, it's quite young. And I think from that perspective, we're seeing incredibly rapid technical progress. The cost of solar, whether it be solar thermal for the heating of water or solar photovoltaic, the generation of electricity, is coming down very quickly. Wind is coming down very quickly in cost. Nuclear is there and well recognized as a technology with costs that we understand. People are investigating more and more biofuels. You've got geothermal, you've got wave. There's so many different forms of technology, and you've got carbon capture and storage for coal and gas, which will be very important too. We're going to need a whole range of these technologies, but the actually encouraging thing is that the progress is pretty rapid in quite a few areas.
You cite three policy instruments that can be used to put a price on greenhouse gas emissions: taxes, trade, regulations. How do you set a price on emissions?
We've got to ask ourselves the question, how fast can we and should we cut the emissions? President Obama has declared, rightly in my view, for at least 80% reductions in the U.S.'s emissions 1990 to 2050. The Waxman-Markey bill is talking about 7% reductions by 2020 relative to 1990. So you have targets of how much you want to cut emissions. And one way of getting there is to say, right, we're going to give out permits. Those permits can be bought and sold, but there are only enough permits to satisfy the kind of targets that we're setting ourselves. And then the market determines what the price of those emissions will be. Another way to do it is through taxes. We should be looking, in my view, over these next 5, 10, 15 years at a price of carbon dioxide at $40 or $50 a tonne. $40 a tonne would add about 40 cents to a gallon of petrol.
And where would the taxes be applied? Would they just go into the general funds, or do you want to see them used to support research and development of new technologies?
That's up for political discussion. You know, you can shift your taxation over from things which you regard as more wholesome, like work, to things that are very damaging, like emissions. And that would mean a tax change which actually reduced some other taxes whilst increasing those taxes. On the other hand, there is a powerful case for investing some of that revenue, in fact, a good part of that revenue, in helping bring forward some of these new technologies. There's also a powerful case for protecting those who would otherwise suffer particularly strongly from a price increase. And there's a powerful case for using some of that revenue for helping the developing world both adapt to climate change and find new technologies suitable for them.
Judging from the debate we've been hearing about taxes in Congress, even now, I suspect this is going to be a rather hard sale.
What we're asking
in Britain, you're much more comfortable with higher taxes.
Nobody likes taxes.
But it pays for your health system. It pays for all sorts of other things that Americans really don't seem to want to see their taxes applied to.
The United States understands the price system. It understands that it's important that those things that are scarce have high prices. It understands the role of markets in guiding the allocation of resources. It's led the world, really, in the analysis and practice of trying to get markets to work well. They don't always work well. In fact, we've seen in the financial markets the markets working badly. What's our reaction to that? We try to fix the markets to get them to work well. Fixing this market is to put a price on carbon dioxide, on greenhouse gas emissions. If we don't, we're allowing markets to fail.
Last week we had a chef here who talked about eating locally produced produce because it cuts down on our carbon footprint. And the end result was that a number of people left comments on our comment line that said, this is all elitism. It leads to higher prices. Be realistic. You go to the supermarket. We can't afford this sort of thing.
We can't afford not to do our analysis and price emissions properly. But when we're looking at what causes emissions, we have to be quite careful and analytical. If you drive to and fro to the supermarket, you're emitting greenhouse gases. Maybe you should drive less often in a more fuel-efficient car. If you just look at the miles, you might fail to notice that they use hot houses in the Netherlands and heat those using energy. You've got to look at it as a whole. You've got to look at all the carbon emissions in the product that you're buying. You've got to ask yourself how you're buying it.
And do you need raspberries in the wintertime?
It's up to you. But the costs associated with raspberries in the wintertime should be reflected in the price of raspberries. And those raspberries, if they're frozen, should be kept in the supermarket on shelves with doors. Because, Walmart actually discovered it could save tremendous amounts of energy by simply putting its frozen items behind doors. So you've got to look at it as a whole. Just to look at the local side of the story is actually quite narrow. But to argue that the prices should not reflect the costs is to argue for inefficiency, it's to argue for market failure. Income distribution does matter, and some of the revenues that we might raise should be going to protect households.
In this country, we often subsidize the food that is less healthy, the production of that, rather than the other way around. Now, this is a global thing, you say. How can this global deal be funded?
Well, the first thing is to get the targets clear and the responsibilities clear. We have to cut emissions for the world by at least 50% 1990 to 2050, and in rich countries by at least 80% 1990.
And who enforces 2050. This?
It will have to be the countries themselves taking into account their responsibilities but recognizing what other countries are doing and working with them. With the right price for carbon emissions, there'll be revenues that can be used to help other countries. There'll be revenues that can be used to help the fight against deforestation. We're going to have to pay to make this transition, because if we don't, we're going to be in deep trouble. We're going to destroy, as it were, the habitat for life on this planet for humans as we know it. So we've got to regard these things as good investments in the future, which are going to lead us to exciting technologies on the way. We might wish we could get it for free, but we can't. And failing to recognize the costs and failing to make the investment is very short-sighted and dangerous.
But you're also saying that a global warming is inevitable. It's just a matter of how bad it's going to be.
Some global warming and climate change is going to happen because of what we've done. But we can change it from being difficult and requiring an adjustment, which is what we will get if we're sensible and act strongly. We can change it from that by not acting into something that's truly catastrophic.
Professor Nicholas Stern is the I.G. Patel Chair and Chairman of the Grantham Institute on Climate Change and the Environment and Director of the India Observatory at the London School of Economics and Political Science. As Baron Stern of Brentford, he is a member of the House of Lords, and he was Chief Economist and Senior Vice President of the World Bank from 2000 to 2003, head of the UK Government Economic Service from 2003 to 2007, and head of the Stern Review on the Economics of Climate Change from 2005 to 2007. And now there's a book that's come out of all of that thinking called The Global Deal, Climate Change and the Creation of a New Era of Progress and Prosperity, published in this country by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure with being you, Leonard. Thank you very much for having me.